Welcome and butter to Crystal Kyle and Friends. Today, we're going to be talking to Zed Jelani. I'm actually really interested in having this conversation because Zed is a really interesting character to me. He was somebody who used to work for Think Progress back when Think Progress did great work.
Yep.
They no longer exist, by the way, but there was a period where they sucked. But when he was there in the golden era, right?
Right.
So he was a great reporter back then, pretty committed lefty. And then what happened to him recently is really interesting. He had a moment where he sort of started flirting with or just outright was a variety of like anti-establishment right winger. And then in recent times, he actually sort of has come back home to the left. It's been really interesting watching his evolution over time. And like he's one of those people where I take him at his word throughout the whole thing. It wasn't like he was ever grifting or like trying to find an angle. He just genuinely felt certain ways at different times.
I think that one of the through lines you could say, and I'm interested to hear, you know, his perspective on this. One of the through lines you can see is he's like very deeply opposed to sectarianism. So when you had this, like, you know, the rise of the quote unquote woke ideology that had this, these very sectarian elements, I think he was deeply genuinely opposed to that. And now that you see like the most sectarian possible viewpoints coming from the pro-Israel right and democratic establishment, I think he also is like deeply repulsed by that.
Yeah. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that we're going to talk to him about. I'm excited for it. But before we get into that, so you've been losing your mind lately. I've been losing my mind lately watching the reaction to these pro-Palestine protests on college campuses. It has been overwhelmingly peaceful to the point where it's almost like shocking. Like, wow, you have thousands and thousands of students and there's like, what, maybe one semi incident people can point to about a window being broken. And that's supposed to be the big gotcha from the establishment. But you guys have seen it. We've covered it. I mean, they're being called Nazis and terrorists and anti-Semites and outside
proxies.
Agitators and Iranian proxies and Hamas proxies and Houthi proxies and Hezbollah proxies. They're throwing everything at these people. And it's been absolutely disgusting to see. So all of this sort of culminated. There are plenty of people out there feeling like you and I feel about this.
I hope so.
One of them being,
like, I'm going insane.
One of them being Cenk Uygur. Yeah. Another one being Cornel West.
Yeah.
And so they went on to Piers Morgan's show. And Piers Morgan sort of set up the segment by giving the most biased framing possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like just straight out of the mainstream media playbook about how, oh my, the rise of anti-Semitism on these college campuses. It is unacceptable. And I care about the safety of Jewish students. Do you care about the safety of the Jewish students who are leading If Not Now and Not In Our Name and the ones that are
Jewish
pro-Palestine?
Voices for Peace.
Jewish Voice for Peace. The ones that are getting their skulls cracked by the NYPD. The ones that are being attacked by Zionists like in UCLA. Do you care about those Jewish students, the pro-Palestine Jewish students? Not a fucking word about them. They're totally erased. It's all about these, by the way, fake cases that propped up. Like when Piers brought this fucking liar on his show, the woman who said, I got poked in the
eye.
She
was on with me.
She was on with you. That's right.
And pretend like, oh, this is a real incident.
And this was before everybody knew for sure she lied.
This is before the video of the actual eye stabbing came out. So
you had to sit there and take this woman at her word. And meanwhile, it comes out later. She's a fucking liar. And you found out she was the dumb bitch who did the Israeli couscous lie. She was like, they changed the name of the couscous in the cafeteria from Israeli couscous. How dare they, anti-Semites?
Imagine showing up at your dining hall and finding they've removed the word Israeli from the couscous.
And that didn't even happen. It was just a lie. She's a liar. She's a fabulous. Anyway, so Piers does this long setup, just hook, line, and sinker, falling for the fucking fake framing of like, you know, there's rampant violence against Israel supporters when it's the exact opposite. And you can see Cornel West and Cenk sort of low-key seething as he does this like long setup where he frames it like that. And then we get this moment.
But if you have people, and we've seen pictures of them inside and outside campus, who appear to be supporting Hamas rhetoric, who are wearing maybe insignia relating to Hamas or Hezbollah or whatever, if you're brazenly supporting organizations, groups of people that are deemed to be terrorists by large swathes of the world, does that cross the line?
This is utter nonsense, Piers. Can I just answer the question?
Okay,
Piers,
check. Yep. I mean,
you got genocide taking place. You got the IDF terrorism taking place. You can't say a mumbling word about 12 universities that have been leveled to the ground. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of professors have been killed. Students have been killed. You're a journalist.
Yes.
Have you talked about the 112 journalists who have been killed, brother?
Yes, I have done.
You just said lies.
Well, hang on. Well, Cornel, I actually...
So
Cornel, hang on.
Cornel.
Cornell.
They're unfair.
Cornell.
And then you just start lying. You start lying, man. It's ridiculous.
Cornell,
man.
I'm not lying about anything.
You are. I agree with Cornell West completely. You're totally, utterly lying through your framing.
Look, I can't hear you both speak at the same time. Cornell, just to be clear, I have posted... Sorry, hang on.
Please.
Hang on. I have posted about the journalists who've died in Gaza, right? I have posted about this. I have highlighted the deaths of those journalists, right?
Put it in the framework.
Well, I'm going to. I was going to come to you about the framework.
No, you're not.
All the vandalism about one hall, and you hardly can say a mumbling word about universities, libraries gone. Completely, schoolrooms gone, completely. You see how truncated and narrow your framework is? You're just lying, man. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Okay. When you say lying, what you're trying to imply that I don't care about the other stuff you've just mentioned.
Yes, that's what I'm
but
saying.
That's not a lie.
That's definitely right.
Well, does not have the same value as an Israeli life. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, let me bring in Cenk. Let me bring in Cenk here. Let me bring in Cenk. Okay, let me bring in Cenk. Just to be clear.
So it was like that the entire time, by the way. We're showing you a little clip that goes on and on and on. So your thoughts, and then I'll give mine.
I mean, it is noteworthy from Dr. West in particular, because normally he's, you know, very
calm. So is Cenk every time he goes on Piers.
He's in love, my brother, whatever. He fucking had it. And I relate to it because I feel so, it's not even gaslighting. It's just an outright lie. These protesters, thousands of them, have been about as perfect as you could be. Many of them Jewish, using long-established campus protest techniques like, yes, occupying a building. God forbid they broke a window. Oh, my God. Let's send in literally 1,000 cops to aggressively arrest them and assault every other campus, by the way, in New York City, too. Oh, and by the way, UT Austin. Oh, and by the way, UCLA. The cops stand back and let a bunch of Zionist agitator thugs funded by fucking Bill Ackman come in and beat the shit out of them. You're not concerned about them. And by the way, Cenk brought that up
many times
and said, okay, you want to talk about student safety? Where's your concern about the UCLA anti-war protesters who are actually the only ones who have been subjected to real violence from protesters? And it was from Zionist protesters. They're the ones that have been actual victims of significant violence. Dozens of them were put in the hospital, by the way.
Yep.
Nothing. In a couple days. He said, that just happened and I haven't had time to figure it out. Okay, really? Well, you had the I've stab bitch on.
Within two seconds.
Exactly. But now, we got to wait and see what happens. And by the way, last night, we're recording this on Thursday, last night what happened is instead of the cops standing by while the lynch mob comes in and beats the shit out of anti-war protesters, instead, last night, the cops went ahead and did it themselves, fired rubber bullets at peaceful protesters. I mean, I'm utterly losing my mind. CNN's Dana Bash with her, it's like the 1930s in Europe. Are you kidding me?
It is like the 1930s in Europe, except Netanyahu is Hitler in that analogy. It's actually like 1942 because they're already in the process of the extermination.
I don't know that I've ever seen anything so dishonest.
I honestly think it has surpassed the Iraq War.
I think so
era.
Too.
That's certainly what it feels like. Because I remember back then, people had differing degrees of skepticism, right? Some people fell hook, line, and sinker for the propaganda coming out of the Bush administration. Some people were like semi-skeptical. Very few, very brave few were like, this is all bullshit, right?
Yeah.
But certainly, like, when wall to wall, the entire narrative from the Democratic Party, from the Republican Party, and from the media, they're all screaming the same thing in unison. Run for the fucking hills. Because you know when they do this? When it's time to bail out Wall Street, when it's time to do the Iraq War, when it's time to do the Patriot Act, now when it's time to smear totally peaceful protesters who just want an end to a fucking genocide. And by the way, I understand the frustration from Cornell and Cenk, because you heard what Pierre said early on in that clip. He said, well, they're supporting Hamas rhetoric, as he says. It's like, really? So your bone to pick in this whole thing is that some people chanted from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And some people chanted fucking intifada. And that's why Cornell West comes in like a bulldozer. And he's like, how often have you talked about every single university in Gaza has been bulldozed to the ground?
That's
every hospital has been fucking bombed. There's barely any functioning hospitals left anymore. Israel bombed, UN buildings. They bombed marketplaces, factories, hundreds of thousands of homes. 2 million people are homeless out of 2.3 million. People are starving. And you're fucking sitting there and you're pissed off about a couple chants on a college campus?
That you find distasteful. And okay. You want to talk about violent rhetoric? How about we talk about Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are literal cabinet-level officials. And not only are they repeatedly saying things so genocidal that an Israeli newspaper called for them to resign or be forced out, but they have power. It's not just their words. Their words are being enacted in the Gaza Strip as we speak. And you're worried about how someone might feel about the word intifada? Like, get the fuck out of here. And by the way, they can be offended. That's fine. We have First Amendment rights.
That's right.
And even offensive speech is protected by those First Amendment rights. There is no hate speech carve out in the First Amendment. Although, to your point about how this has gone beyond, I think clearly beyond the Iraq war hysteria, now you have Congress trying to make a hate speech carve-out in the First Amendment.
They passed it.
They just passed through the House overwhelmingly. There are, I think, 91 dissenters, 71 Democrats, and 20 Republicans who said this is insane. The rest of the entire Congress voted to codify a version of anti-Semitism as official and actionable by the Department of Education that basically bans any criticism of Israel and says, by the way, the thing you just said about Bibi being a Nazi and the Israeli government enacting, you know, Nazi-esque policies in the Gaza Strip, that's banned. That's directly prohibited by this legislation that our Congress just overwhelmingly voted for. I'm sure the Senate will overwhelmingly vote for it. I'm sure Joe Biden will sign it into law without a hesitation.
But you know what? This is going to be a rare instance where the Supreme Court saves us.
I fucking hope so.
Because they're going to slap it down.
I hope so.
The Supreme Court has consistently upheld free speech, even to the point where people like Antonin Scalia said, I don't like it, but it's perfectly allowed free speech to ban an American, to burn an American flag.
Yeah.
So I have no doubt that the Supreme Court will come out on the right side of this, which is good. But this hysteria is absolutely insane.
I have no confidence in anything at this point.
By the way, to your point, a day before Piers did this shitty fucking segment, it was either Ben-Gvir or Smotrich, I remember because we covered it on my show, he just called for total annihilation of Gaza.
It was Smotrich.
And brought up Amalek again.
Yep.
And the story of Amalek in the Bible, it's like, don't spare fucking any of them. Kill them all.
He said, moments before redemption, we must not hesitate. We must destroy Rafa. And then he names two other places. Wipe out the memory of Amalek. There's no half measure. Rafa, Deir al-Balah, Nusret. Absolute destruction.
But of course, you know, instead.
But what did a 19-year-old at UCLA maybe possibly say, according to a pro-Zionist agitator?
Yeah.
That's what we really need to talk about.
Absolutely. The fact of the matter is, when it came to the Vietnam War protests, everybody in the moment hated those people.
Mm-hmm.
They smeared those people.
That's right.
They thought they were disgusting. They thought they were un-American. They thought they were communist. They thought they were on the side of the Viet Cong. The Iraq War. You remember the Iraq War days?
Oh, yeah.
I remember the Iraq War days. They would say, why do you support Saddam Hussein? Why do you hate our troops? They would call you unpatriotic.
You're siding with the terrorists.
Mm-hmm. All these things. And then guess what? Over time, in both of those scenarios, everybody came to acknowledge, okay, you know what? The anti-war protesters were right in Vietnam.
Yeah.
The anti-war protesters were right in Iraq. The same fucking thing is going to happen here. And it's driving me crazy that people don't recognize it.
The
entire media with their conventional wisdom is exactly dead wrong. And it's driving me crazy. I feel so gaslit.
Yeah.
So I do want to bring up, though, because, and I'm curious what you think about this, because my one point of strategic disagreement with Cenk and Cornel West there is it kind of derails the conversation when Cornel West screams at Piers Morgan that he's a racist. And then Piers Morgan from that moment on kind of played the victim in the rest of the conversation.
Yeah.
And the conversation became about Piers Morgan defending himself from being a racist and basically telling Cornel West and Cenk to some extent that, like, you know, you guys are too quick to use that term. And so the original debate was sort of lost in the weeds of this accusation against Piers Morgan, when the fact of the matter is, you were winning that debate 10 out of 10 times without bringing that point up. You know what I'm saying? I think it derailed the conversation to the point where the focus was no longer on, here's what's happening in Gaza, there's a genocide, you're ruthlessly smearing these protesters who are doing a phenomenal job. I'm curious if you agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, Cornell and Cenk are 100% right. It is a fundamentally racist worldview that would allow you to care more about the purported feelings about a rally chant of a American college student than about the tens of thousands of Gazans who have been slaughtered. Like, it can only be grounded in a racist worldview. I just think that's undeniably true. But especially the way it was presented as, like, not making that more meta point, which certainly applies to peers, but to make it very directly at peers, yeah, then he can be like, oh, that's so unfair, and why did this turn personal, blah, blah, blah. And
yeah.
It's just not the... The point is so clear and so strong about the double standard and about the way this is all such an obvious manufactured moral panic to do anything that they can to distract from the justice of these kids' cause of ending the genocide in Gaza and stopping the slaughter of babies. And that's why the crackdown is happening right now, is because they had really won that argument. There was no leg left to stand on. And so the only thing they had left was to smear this entire movement, try to crush dissent, pass these, you know, laws even banning any sort of a dissent. They were left with what is basically desperate measures here in the end. That's just so clear and such a strong point to stand on, especially when you have the example of UCLA and these counter-protesters who were the only ones who were actually violent, that to make it about whether Piers Morgan, like what's going on in the heart of Piers Morgan, was probably not the best debate tactic.
Yeah, and the final two points I want to make. Number one, strategic. Cenk has been on Piers Morgan show a lot recently, and I covered a lot of his exchanges because I think he did a phenomenal job.
Yeah.
Strategically, he's been on point every time, and his goal is like, it's been, let me be calm, relaxed, and sort of describe everything clearly in the proper moments, express empathy for the side I don't agree with, to then put it back in perspective and give the, you know, correct response. He even did this against monsters like Rabbi Shmuley.
Yeah.
And in every single one of those debates, it came out where, you know, you'd read the comments and it would be, everybody's like, this fucking Rabbi Shmuley guy is insufferable. He's yelling over people. He's doing ad hominem attacks left and right. And so Cenk went out of all of those interviews the undeniable massive victor. I think that because he was feeling like we were feeling about this, that sort of made it so he deviated from his strategy a little bit, and him and Cornel West did the whole, like, we're going to scream over you type thing. And I just think from a strategic perspective that that's it's never going to be as flawless of a victory. And also there's a problem with the microphones where, like, Cenk's mic and Cornel West mic, to an even greater degree, when they would try to make a point and somebody else would interject and Piers would interject,
yeah,
you couldn't hear them at all. It just became like the Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
And so that part didn't really work. But the final thing I want to say is I'm so sick of Piers both sidism. I'm just so sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't look at this situation right here and now and acknowledge, you know what? This is black and white.
Yeah.
This is super fucking black and white. Yeah. Sometimes it's a very straightforward world. I acknowledge that oftentimes there's a lot of nuance, there's a lot of shades of gray. This is not one of those situations.
Yeah.
It's just not. And for him to do the, like, because he's done this a million times, like, if you have on a pro-Palestine, do you condemn Hamas? And it's like, well, as Mehdi Hassan pointed out,
Jesus Christ,
he never does that with people who come on who are supporting Israel. Do you support the IDF? Are the IDF terrorists? He's never said the words Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. In fact, in this same interview, he does this bullshit fucking point about Intifada, which drives me crazy. He actually did it in a recent interview with Mehdi Hassan, and Mehdi corrected his ass, and you even brought this up on the show when you were there. They make this bullshit point about, like, if they're chanting Intifada, that means they want to genocide all Jews. And it's like, you know that's fucking bullshit. You know the word Intifada means uprising.
Right.
You know an interpretation of Intifada could literally just mean Palestinians have a right to defend themselves against wanton aggression and genocide, right? It could also mean 2018-style Great March or Return type shit. Intifada just means uprising. The fact that he insists it must be violent, I mean, it's just such a fucking bullshit point, and it feeds into this both sides narrative. And I think now he's struggling with the whole fence-sitting thing, because in a situation like this, you're getting pulverized by the pro-Palestine people because they're right, because they see how much you're gaslighting people and how skewed your framework is when you describe this as if the pro-Palestine protesters are being fucking violent, when that's not remotely true.
His show is literally called Piers Morgan Uncensored. And then the whole thing is like, but we need to censor these people. Like, I don't like the word Intifada. And you know what? Even like the interpretation of it is so insane. And even again, also knowing history, the first Intifada was overwhelmingly nonviolent, by the way, but putting all of that aside, even if they were saying we want to do a genocide, guess what? It's still protected. It's still protected.
But they're not saying that.
But they're not saying that.
The only ones saying that are the leaders of Israel.
it's just the last thing I'll say, just this has been irritating me. The four people debates.
Horrible.
It's too fucking many people.
Oh.
It's too fucking many people. Have one person versus one person. Let them do their thing, like, in a way that's not insane and off. He just, it's so tabloid the way that he does this.
I forgot to mention, I was supposed to be on this panel.
Yeah, we think
it was
so.
I think it was supposed to be me. I think I would probably replace Cenk. They had asked me to do it, and I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm happy that's the case, because I, again, just like you, I cannot stand the four. All you could just have peers in one person, and that's it, and you're good.
Yeah,
at most, you do
Cenk.
Is peers in two.
Or
that's
peers
it.
In Dr. West. Like, whatever. And the other people there, Kat Timpf was there.
She did good.
She's fine. She's just raising, like, some of the free speech points that we raised here. And this other psycho.
Some fucking grifter. Total fucking grifter.
Never heard of this guy. Just, like, talking about some bucket that they
saw.
Yeah,
the protesters are defecating in a bucket. So fucking what? Who are you? Fuck you.
Just total, like,
grift,
tabloid.
Grift, total
insane.
Grift. He's a grifter.
Whatever.
Whoever that guy was, I don't even know his fucking name. He's irrelevant. Grifter.
Completely. Yeah. And he got in some side debate with Cornel West about, like, he'd never been discriminated against.
Yeah,
as a black
he did the whole, like, shut
like,
up.
Okay, I see who you're playing to.
He did the whole shut up about race type thing. Right wingers, give me money, give me money, give me money. Fuck off.
Yep.
Hate these people.
Totally.
All right. We do have one more story, though, before we get to Zed Jelani. Crystal, take it away.
Yeah.
This is about
so
Candace
this is
Owens
interesting.
And Ben Shapiro.
So you guys will recall Candace Owens fired from Daily Wire over, she had voiced legitimately, I would say, anti-Semitic things. But the thing that really got her fired was when she was consistently critical of the Israeli government. After she's fired, I don't know if you guys follow this. There's a whole back and forth between her and Jeremy Boring and Shapiro about, like, all right, let's debate, right? And there was some negotiation about when and how and whatever. And it seemed like there was an agreement about timing and, you know, structure and no moderation and all this stuff. But the debate never happened. So people have been going, well, what the hell happened here? Why didn't this debate happen? Well, Glenn Greenwald got the scoop. Apparently, the Daily Wire, while they were publicly pretending like they wanted to do this debate with Candace, they were privately using a private arbitrator to issue a gag order against her so that she can't say anything. And by the way, and so that's the real reason the debate hasn't happened, is because they issued a gag order against her. And by the way, in obtaining this gag order, the things that they cited as her, they said, okay, she had a non-disparagement agreement. She violated that. And what they used as evidence of her violating it was that she had publicly asked for a debate. And then she had liked some tweets that were critical of the Daily Wire. That was their case.
That's
for
enough
how,
to get a gag
how
order?
How she had disparaged them and, yes, that they used in order to get a gag order.
That can legally allow you to get a gag order.
Apparently.
Okay, so my first thought is that, remember the fight between Ben Shapiro and Steven Crowder?
Yes.
Where Steven Crowder was going around, they only offered me $50 million. Yeah. This is slavery.
Yeah.
Everybody in the world who's reasonable looked at that and was like, Steven Crowder's a fucking idiot. And the Daily Wire was under. I actually liked the way they handled that. Jeremy Boring, the CEO of Daily Wire, came out and he literally showed line by line the contract that was offered to Steven Crowder. And he was like, look, even if he doesn't like it, this was an opening offer. He had, he could have, counteroffered and we'd be having the conversation. Instead, he decided to go nuclear on us and call us sellouts and things of that nature, right?
Right.
What the Daily Wire did here is such a fucking Steven Crowder-esque move.
Mm.
Steven Crowder has been gagging Not Gay Jared, who, by the way, I'm sure is very not gay, because his name is Not Gay Jared.
That's
right?
Everything you need to know.
So he's been gagging... that sounds sexual. He's been gagging him with his balls and his cock. this segment's going off the rails. And he's gagged a lot of his other employees as well with his dick and balls. Still off the rails. All right, I'm gonna try to get the train back on the tracks here. But like the whole Steven Crowder is like a petty authoritarian in the workplace. That's what he is.
Yeah.
On top of being a sexual assaulter and teabagging people and all sorts of that guy's got serious problems, man. He's got serious psychosexual problems.
It seems
that's
like
obvious.
It. Yeah.
But that's what this is. Like, okay, look, I would actually understand the perspective of Ben Shapiro and the Daily Wire if they were just like, look, I don't take Candace Owens seriously. I actually think it was a mistake to hire her. I think she's a joke of a commentator. I don't think she has any idea what the fuck she's talking about fucking anything. I think she's a grifter. I think she picked a lane. If they said all that and then said, that's why we're not going to debate her, I don't take her seriously, I'd be like, look, I understand people disagreeing with that, but it's a fair position. Fine. Fair enough, right?
Right.
But that's not what they're doing. They're pretending like we're going to debate her. And then they're doing a gag order and they're like, we're never going to debate you.
So weaselly.
It's so fucking weaselly. It's so weaselly.
Especially since Ben Shapiro is, you know, he's such a like, oh, free speech and ideas and debate me, whatever. You know, I mean, he wrote a whole book about like, what was his book? Destroying Liberals with Facts and Logic or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, he had some dumb book about like how to win every argument or something. And he sells mugs that say like liberal tears on it. And it's like, stop pretending like you're the guy.
Tough guy.
I'm in favor of reasonable discourse. Like, no, your whole thing is I'm going to own the other side no matter fucking what, even if I got to lie and use Weasley tactics.
It's really something when you're putting me in the corner of defending Candace Owens. But
I know,
there's just like no doubt here that this is such skeezy, like Weasley underhanded behavior.
Absolutely.
To publicly be out there, of course we will name a time. We'll be there. We want to have this debate. And then behind the scenes, you're like,
judge,
please help me. Make sure she can never say anything about us.
Please.
She's so mean.
Please help me.
Do you see this? She publicly asked us for a debate. How could she? This is disparagement. Unbelievable.
It's
so embarrassing for them.
In an Israel debate, Ben Shapiro is super well-versed on the Israeli Hasbara.
Oh, yeah.
And he would crush Candace Owens.
He'd be difficult.
He would crush her.
Difficult.
No, I think he would crush her.
You think so?
Yes. I mean, he's wrong about all of it, but he knows enough stuff and he knows the Israeli Hasbara playbook where he has an answer for everything.
You're not going to catch him off guard.
You're not going to catch him off guard. He knows every single fucking dumb response, but he sells it well, right? And I think he'd crush Candace. And instead of doing that, he's doing this.
So here's what Glenn writes in his piece. He says, while the company claimed before the arbitrator that it did not object in principle to a, quote, healthy debate, it urged the imposition of a gag order on Owens by claiming that the way she requested the debate constituted disparagement of Shapiro and the site. To justify the gag order, it wanted the company also cited various criticisms of the Daily Wire and Shapiro on X that Owens had liked. That was it. At least according to Glenn, that was it.
So
that was
petty.
Her disparagement.
And remember, you pointed this out, but remember when Candace Owens made the argument that like, look, if Hitler was just trying to make Germany great again, that'd be one thing. The problem is he was a globalist and he went beyond his borders. Right. It's like, that's not really the main problem with Hitler.
Right. Well, and he hired her after that. That was
no. Yeah, that's
that
my point.
Fine. Yeah.
But then went across the line. Kate defended her even when she was doing the whole Kanye defense.
Yeah,
when he was
right.
Like, I'm going to go DEFCON 3 on the Jews or whatever
that's
it was.
Right.
And she was even still defending him when he did his pro-Hitler meltdown, saying, I love Hitler.
That's right.
And there was no consequences. Again, the time where there were consequences was when, after October 7th, right? When,
yeah.
And there, all of a sudden, a month in or whatever, there's a lot of criticism of the Israeli government. She echoed some of them, and then it's like,
yeah.
Gone.
You actually, I mean, you see this kind of commonly on the right.
Sure.
Where, like, actual, like, aggressive neo-Nazism and whatever, or like Kanye or Candace's comments, etc. That's fine. Just don't criticize the state of Israel.
Yeah.
That's the hard line.
That marriage, by the way, that marriage is ethno-staters loving ethno-staters.
Yeah.
That's why there's a little bit of a, you know.
Yeah. There were,
don't fight each other mentality with the white supremacists and the Zionists.
Yeah. As an example, there were neo-Nazis marching in Charleston, West Virginia that they were fine with. But oh, my God, on college campuses, they don't like the war. We've got to, you know, we've got to completely destroy free speech and send in a fucking 1,000 NYPD cops and crack their skulls and whatever. They're practically terrorists. But actual neo-Nazis marching? No, we're good with that. That's fine. All right. Very excited to talk to you. Long time friend, someone who I really have a lot of respect for. Just he's smart and interesting and I think always challenging thinker, Zed Jelani, independent journalist. Let's get to it.
All right. Welcome to the show, Zed Jelani. He is an independent reporter. He was formerly with The Intercept. And before that, he was with Think Progress. This was back when Think Progress did really good work.
Actually good. And existed.
Yeah. And Zed, you're a guy who's been really fascinating to me for quite a long time. I mean, I've been following your stuff since all the way back to the Think Progress days. I probably used a million of the things that you wrote on air when I was doing my show all the way back in, you know, whatever, 2014, 2015, or whenever it was. You're a really interesting dude to me because, and correct me where I'm wrong in my understanding of the situation. I'm curious what your perspective is. It looked to me like you went from being like a very committed lefty to sort of flirting with a brand of anti-establishment right-wing politics and now sort of coming back home to the left. So what happened with your political evolution and how do we end up here?
Yeah, it's funny. I think a lot of people ask me that because it's not always clear from the outside. And honestly, it's not always clear with me, right? I feel like if there's a consistent theme in the work that I've been doing, is it's probably the second thing that you mentioned, right? You know, being anti-establishment, right? I think that there's a little bit of a trap you can get into on both sides of that coin. One is, I think if you're always kind of stuck and hewing to conventional thinking or the zeitgeist, you can be in a bubble. But also if you're just completely contrary to whatever is mainstream or to whatever is being presented or discussed or debated, you can also be in a bubble, right? I mean, it's not, you need to be trying to figure things out as independently as you can in an environment where it's often difficult to do that, right? Because you have jobs, you have audience capture, you have social pressures. And, you know, I think some people, they just, they enjoy the contrarian kind of aspect or instinct, right? Which for me, I've never actually enjoyed that. Like, I actually feel very bad when I have to be the one person in a room of 20 people to be like, well, I don't actually think that's right. It feels kind of, like awkward. And I've often been that person when I was in DC or when I was elsewhere working on other projects. But I do have that kind of nagging feeling that I should do that at times when I see something that's off. And so I think some people will describe me as contrarian in that aspect, but it's not necessarily the case. You know, like, I think a lot of people fell into the anti-vaccine stuff, right? Like a lot of the, particularly the independent media people. And I never thought there was any reason to be that. Like, logically, factually, I did not see the evidence for their position. So I didn't, you know, I didn't take it, but I understand the pull for a lot of people, right? And I think there was a little bit of a reward for people to kind of take that position. So, yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily try to slot myself into a political party. I want to call it as I see it. But I do think that as things change, I have to change as well, right? I have to see, you know, whether people who profess to believe in freedom of expression really do believe in freedom of expression, or whether it's an opportunistic thing, or whether, you know, when circumstances change, they no longer believe in it because they're the ones on top, right? Yeah. So that's one example of many, I think, where, you know, you have to be a little bit flexible to be able to cover these things in as incisive and as accurate a way as possible, as helpful a way as possible, I think.
Talk a little bit more about that freedom of expression piece, because, I mean, it has been extraordinary. Like, people who built a whole brand on, like, the most important thing in the world is protecting free speech on college campus. And now you're in favor of, like, the most militant crackdown on free speech on college campus I've ever seen in my lifetime, including during the Iraq War. Was it always clear to you that positioning was very, you know, situationally dependent, very hollow, very convenient, very, you know, used tactically as politically a political weapon in the moment? Or did you see more sincerity in that view and the, you know, the corners of the right in particular that were all about free speech until now, when Marsha Blackburn's like, actually, let's put these students on the no-fly list?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. As far as how I viewed how sincere other people were, I think I tended to view them as being more sincere when they were kind of in the driver's seat, right? Because I think everyone's in favor of freedom of expression or speech when they need it to be able to get their point of view across or their point of view out, right?
Yeah.
But when they're in the driver's seat, it's very different, right? Sometimes I think they start to crumble in that aspect or that respect. And, you know, I think the Republicans in Congress are a very good example of this, as well as some of the Republican governors and lawmakers at the state level. I think when they felt like they were not able to say their piece about their, I don't know, their arguments about transgender stuff, their arguments about race, they were very adamant about freedom of speech and expression. Actually, Governor Abbott, you know, I think it was either an executive order or actually maybe even legislation promoting freedom of speech on Texas campuses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, you know, we've seen such an intense kind of crackdown on so many campuses across America. And actually, the House Republicans just passed a bill where they're trying to, one, define anti-Semitism, which is very difficult to define. It's always debated for good reason, as any other kind of prejudice is debated. But two, actually punish colleges and universities that do not adhere to their definition, right? Which is, to me, the most extreme attack on speech that I've seen in my lifetime, right?
Agreed.
I don't think anything that, you know, I a few months ago, I was in a debate with on a podcast with Noam Dorman. He owns the Comedy Center in New York. He's very sympathetic to Israel, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he was telling me, but look, all these lefties are hypocrites because they'll censor you for not being saying the right pronouns and stuff, but they're okay saying all this stuff about Israel. And I said, well, you know, think about it this way. Compare like to like, right? I've never heard of anyone being censored for advocating for war with Iran, right? I never heard anyone being censored for saying something too harsh or even racist against Palestinians or about Palestinian society or statehood. I think generally speaking, campuses have let you speak as much as you want about foreigners just because foreigners don't have that much political power in the United States. They're not really, it's not really a hot button culture issue. But what they did is they turned Israel into a hot button culture issue, right? Where it's not that you're making a debate about foreign policy. It's not that you're making a debate about what America's government should do in its diplomatic status or so on and so forth. They're turning it into, this is a personal attack against Jewish students, right? Mm-hmm. So they did. That's they right. actually did the exact same thing as the people they're criticizing about, right?
That's
like
right.
if you disagree about women in sports or how, one of those hot button culture issues, some people on the left will say that's a personal attack against transgender women. It's offensive. You shouldn't be allowed to question their humanity. Okay, I you know, whatever you say on that debate, I don't think it's necessarily an act of discrimination or subjugation to do that. I don't think you're harassing anyone to do that. I think it's a debate. I think the exact same thing. If you think Israel should be, a lot of these young kids think Israel should be like a binational or secular democratic state. One person, one vote, Palestinian and Israelis who live under it. I don't know if that's the most immediately practical policy to promote, but I don't think it's anti-Semitic. I don't think you're promoting hatred against Jews or discriminating against anyone to say that. But the House Republicans are saying that, right? The House Republicans, almost all of them, I think like 20 of them voted against the resolution or 21 maybe. But almost all of them are saying that various policy positions you can take around the state of Israel now denote anti-Semitism, they denote personal prejudice and bigotry, and that they will actually punish your college and university if your college and university does not prevent that speech from being aired, right? They've internalized this foreign policy issue into this kind of you're threatening the personal safety of someone if you disagree with them kind of thing, right?
Right.
And that is almost the exact same thing that I think they were complaining about for the past, you know, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, right? And, you know, in that sense, they are all hypocritical. I mean, in their minds, I don't know if they're hypocritical because maybe they just think, oh, well, you did it to us, we'll do it to you. Or alternatively, I think more likely, the Republicans, I think, just see a political opportunity here, right? I don't think this was well thought through. I don't think they brought in a panel of experts. Even the guy, by the way, who created the definition of anti-Semitism that they're using doesn't agree with the law. He's been on CNN saying that, on CNN International saying that. I don't know why Domestic didn't bring him on, you know, go figure. But, you know, Kenneth Stern, who's a Jewish scholar. And if they really wanted to think through how to deal with prejudice, they could do it in like a very long, complicated process. I don't think that's what they're doing. I think what they're doing is this. They're seeing that this is an issue that is polarizing the country. They're seeing that Democrats, more or less at this point, are very hostile to the war in Gaza. You know, like maybe 70 or 80% of them have a very negative view of Benjamin Netanyahu, a very negative view of the war. I don't think that all of them necessarily agree with everything that's happening in the protests, because the protests have their own kind of range of views, and there's some very hard left elements in the protests as well. But I think what they think is that they can put the Democrats on defensive and divide them, and to some extent they're correct, right? In New York City, I think the extent of the crackdowns happened because of, you know, combinations from probably donor pressure, political pressure, and the Democrats are kind of fighting themselves over this issue, and the Republicans, I think, are enjoying it, right? So it's not even a principal thing to them. It's probably more of a political thing to them.
And, it's, you know, very uniting. It's a classic wedge issue.
Right.
Very uniting for Republicans who are 100% on board the Zionist Israel, no matter what train.
Right.
And it is divisive for Democrats, where you have even some elected Democrats who are not on board that train. And actually, a huge disconnect between elite Democrats like Joe Biden and the Democratic base. So it's like a perfect wedge issue for them.
I think the Republicans are out over their skis, though, because there's a decent number of conservatives who are not really on board with this, like, we're going to totally cuck ourselves to Israel in every imaginable way.
Yeah, no, that is true. What do you think about that, Zed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some. I think the challenge, though, is that most of the Republicans who would be dissenting against this policy would be younger, and they don't necessarily, or they would be in, like, alternative kind of spaces outside the party, or maybe, like, the few libertarians like Thomas Massie or Rand Paul or Justin Amash. I just don't think they have that much power over party leadership. And the thing is, the Republicans have really two incentives to take their position that they do. Because, you know, what they actually believe is always like kind of secondary for a politician. You know, the first thing is this politically safe or advantageous to do? So there's two reasons they would have to take their position. One is they have a very strong Christian evangelical base, right? There's quite a few people, particularly in the region I live in, if you talk like older Republicans, who really believe that they have to support everything the modern nation state of Israel does because it's part of their religious scripture, right? They think that it'll bring about the end times, and it's important for there to be an Israeli government there to bring that about because it'll be a conflict that'll bring about the end times, and then eventually that will basically be the culmination of their religious prophecy, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually a fairly strong element among the Republican Party, among the Christian right, right? It's not a marginal thing at all. The organization Christians United for Israel, which is the main Christian Zionist organization that promotes this ideology, has about 10 million people. Ooh. 10 million people is actually larger than the entire Jewish population of the United States, wow. Right? It's almost the Jewish population plus the Muslim population put together is Christians United for Israel, right? It's like it's a fairly prominent and powerful organization. A lot of Republican politicians will speak there. It's almost like kind of an AIPAC just for the right. I mean, it has no appeal among Democrats, right? Because even Christian Democrats really don't believe in this apocalyptic theory. In fact, most Christians in the world do not believe in this apocalyptic theory. It's very much like a 70s, 80s dispensationalist kind of millenarian kind of Christianity that was kind of born in the United States. The Bible doesn't actually talk about a modern nation state of Israel. It doesn't really have anything to do with any of this. Like, actually, some of the Palestinians are descendants of some of the people talked about in the Bible, probably, if you really trace it back. But anyway, that's one part of it. And the other part of it is also donors, right? I've talked to people who worked on the right for a long time who've just said that, yeah, like the Republicans and the conservatives are really trying to accrue like Jewish donors and donors who like, you know, the Sheldon Adelson types of the world, the Chaim Saban types of the world, the people who can put millions of dollars into party committees, into political campaigns. Because I don't think they can really win that much of the Jewish vote, because the Jewish vote, by and large, is a very liberal vote. They're very pro-choice, so on and so forth. And I think, you know, if it wasn't Donald Trump, maybe they would win a larger portion of the Jewish vote, but he's very unpopular among Jewish Americans. And I really doubt that they can win a lot of the vote. But what they could do is maybe peel some of the donors off from Biden and the Democrats because they see them as insufficiently supporting the cause at the moment. And so I think those two things combined give them a very, very strong incentive to take the position that they're taking, even though they will get some dissent from some Republicans who maybe are grating at the idea that they're doing so much for a foreign government or a foreign country, when maybe they're not doing enough for Americans or they're not doing enough for the border. I think that there is that element in the Republican Party. There's also some Republicans who I think see them hypocritical on freedom of speech. You know, they think, okay, if they start outlawing, they're not really outlawing, but they start punishing criticisms of Israel, maybe next the Democrats will respond and punish criticisms of Ukraine or something, right? Like, I think that is an element of the GOP. And maybe in the next generation, when young Republicans are less religious and maybe a little bit less racist too, because quite frankly, I think there's also a lot of the GOP base who just sees Israel as a vanguard of kind of like, you know, Western civilization, fighting the airports, blah, 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 all that stuff. They don't really see much of a distinction between the Arabs. They don't really think that much about the way that Palestinians are treated just in their day-to-day lives, which doesn't really correspond to any conservative or libertarian values. It's more of an authoritarian kind of arrangement. But they do, you know, they do see that. And I think those two elements are why the Democrats are changing, right? Young Democrats are much less religious than older Democrats. And they're probably the least racist generation of people that ever existed on planet Earth, right? Like, they don't see a giant distinction in worthiness between, you know, a Palestinian shepherd in the West Bank whose, you know, farm is raided four times a year by settler mobs who are pushing him around and killing his sheep and, you know, burning down his olive trees. They think that person is worth just as much as anyone else on Earth, right? Which is actually a very radical idea, right? Like, all throughout human civilization, people usually put different worth on people from various tribes or creeds or religions or, you know, racial categories, so on and so forth. The youngest generation of Americans is very hostile to that idea. I think they were raised in just kind of the right time in a post-civil rights childhood with the set of values that actually is very, very colorblind in that sense, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, plus them being much less religious, I think is leading them to respond to this very, very differently than maybe an older generation of Americans who I think, you know, many of them, I think, saw Israel as an underdog in these conflicts, like in 1967, right? Like, they fought all these powerful kind of Middle Eastern Arab armies, and they were victorious. If you're young in the United States, you've never really seen Israel, like, fight a powerful country, right? You've seen them kind of be in a quarrel with refugees who they're not allowing to be independent or to they're not really allowing them to be free and self-governing. They're controlling their land, their water, their food, where they get to live. you know, it, to you, it looks like what you read about in your textbooks about civil rights, or what you read about, or you read about in school about South Africa, right?
That's right.
One of the most angry group of people about this, it's barely covered in media, is like Southern Black pastors. They're like furious about it. They've been, hundreds of them are signing letters to President Biden. They're, I think they're communicating very much so to probably Senators Ossoff and Warnock, my senators, which is why I think both, part of the reason why both of them, I think, have been a little bit more on the critical side to the left of Biden on this issue. And, you know, that's not who I think Netanyahu wants to hold up. He wants to hold up an 18-year-old. And at 18, nobody is 100% like, I know, when I was 18, I was a little wild. No one's 100% like polished and prim and proper on the news media when you're 18.
I was perfect. I don't care what anybody says. I was developed fully.
I mean, said I'm losing my mind watching what's unfolding before us, because like you said, I mean, they're using anything they can, like any goofy statement from a 19-year-old or any rally chant they can even colorably like interpret as being quote unquote genocidal, anything they can to have the most, you know, aggressive authoritarian crackdown on speech that I've seen. And I mean, they're talking about safety of Jewish students, completely erasing the fact that many Jewish students are in the anti-war protests, who are leading the anti-war protests. You're completely erasing the fact that the most violent incident we've seen so far at UCLA was entirely one-sided, coming from the pro-Israel Zionist, like actual outside agitators. And I just wonder, you know, how you're processing this and whether you think this agitprop is successful. Like, are they persuading the American public that there's a massive outbreak of 1930s style rabid anti-Semitism at universities across the country? Like, are American people actually being convinced that our own kids are literal Nazis?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because I haven't really seen a lot of surveys about this in particular. We know that the war was becoming very unpopular, right? By the time April hit, like 60%.
I think that's why this is happening now, because the war is unpopular. They lost the debate, so this is the next move.
Right.
So it probably cuts two ways. One, among Republicans, they're probably very successful at, like you said, uniting their party. I think also there's like a savior complex among Republicans sometimes, right? Like with the war in Iraq, there was very much like, we're liberating these people. Like, there was a huge complex among Republicans. And now I think the complex they're trying to inculcate is that, like, we're saving Jews, right? It's like us protecting Jews, who, by the way, don't even vote for us. And they don't affiliate with us, but we're their protectors. We're protecting them against, you know, the hordes of kids, largely Arabs, but they usually don't drop in the Arab part, but like that's what the insinuation is, right? And so it, to some extent, I think they are uniting them in that cause or that regard in a way that they weren't able to unite their party in a number of other issues like Ukraine or the border, where they have a lot of inter-party dissent and kind of anger at the leadership. But on this issue, they kind of did unite them. The dissent is very marginal. And I think that maybe it is kind of a mobilizing issue for them. Now, have they successfully convinced Americans that this is the biggest issue in the world? I think part of the challenge of doing that is that this isn't like summer 2020 where there's riots and like cities are burning down or anything, right? Like, it's actually very peaceful for the most part. Hundreds of thousands of people have taken part. You have a handful of incidents of like scuffles, right? I think it's a little bit harder to turn this into a toxic issue among most Americans when you don't really have that happening to the country. It's not really impacting people. People aren't really afraid of it. But, you know, I do think that it probably is having the most impact on, like, these college presidents, right? So, for instance, like Columbia, it was, like, the epicenter of a lot of this, right? People are saying, well, they're camped out. They're in a building. Those are violations of Columbia's rules. That's all true. It is a violation of their rules. But that's happened many times in Columbia's history. In the 1980s, students took over that very same building for 3 weeks to win divestment from South Africa, right? Columbia did not call in the police. Mm-hmm. Columbia did not evict them. Columbia negotiated with them, right? And I remember when I was in college at UGA, someone came from Harvard. Harvard also, I think it was about 3 weeks or maybe a little bit longer. They did a sit-in in a building for weeks on end to win living wages for their campus janitors. Harvard purposely decided not to arrest them or evict them because they thought it would ruin relationship with the campus community. I think what a lot of these university leaders are thinking, looking at what happened to Claudine Gay, looking at what happened at UPenn, they're thinking that they're going to get a lot of pressure from Congress, going to get a lot of pressure from university donors. So they better crack down to save their own hides, right? But it's also doing what would have happened if Harvard or Columbia had cracked down in previous years, which is that it's ruining their campus relationship, right? I think the faculty are very antagonistic to the president at Columbia now. Where I live at Emory, the faculty, I think, absolutely hate the president at Emory now, right? So I don't know what the long-term impact of that is. I don't know if that means that, like, for the short term, avoiding some political pressure from the Republicans and or the state of Israel, they're going to be particularly harsh or brutal towards their students, and that's just going to alienate the entire campus community. I don't know what the long-term impact of that will be just for these institutions. It may, you know, it may actually end up in the long term creating a little bit more democracy in these places if the faculty and the students, the administrators decide that the presidents need to be more accountable to them rather than to these outside political forces. I mean, I'm not sure. And also, I think, look, Netanyahu's playing a little bit of a dangerous game because he's decided to try to focus the world on 18, 19-year-old kids. And maybe, you know, they don't have as much political influence right now. Like these young Jewish kids that are at the protests and supporting the protests and supporting Palestinian rights and ending the war, they don't have as much influence as their like boomer and Gen X parents, right? Who are the ones who run the organizations and have good jobs and homes and blah, 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 and political influence that are in Congress, blah, blah, blah. But those kids are going to grow up one day, right? And they're going to remember how they were treated, the way that they were talked about, the harshness with which these universities and Congress and people responded. And it may be that Netanyahu, by demonizing this group of people right now, thinks he's in the safest spot to do that because they're not that politically powerful. And it's distracting from what he's doing and from what Congress is doing, which is arming and funding the war. But it may be that he's just given up on persuading this younger generation because guess what? Older people die off. Younger people get older. They become the new power elite, right? These kids are going to be, I mean, the conservative trope about how these kids grow up, take over the world, it's actually going to be true this time. And normally kids do change their views a little bit as they get older. Everyone cools off a little bit, moderates a little bit. But the worse that you treat them, I think the less they're going to go in your direction, right? They're at least going to remember this. They're going to remember how harsh this was. They're going to remember the kind of things politicians were saying about them.
That's right.
And that is going to change how they view things in the future as well and how they raise their kids to think as well. So
that's right.
It may be that, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face, it may be what's happening here for them.
So here's the thing. I in part agree and in part disagree. I definitely think they lost a generation of the youth. I think that goes double for the media with the way that they've handled this. I mean, it's a totally radicalizing moment. I think that's all true. But the part of this that I can't work my way around is that you had multimillionaires and billionaires, people like Robert Kraft went on TV and said, I'm not going to give money to Columbia anymore. You're not cracking down on these protests. And as long as they're kowtowing to the big money, I don't see how that lost generation of youth gets into the position where we are the decision makers, right? Because all the big money is lined up on one side of this issue. It's lined up on the Zionist side of this issue. And even if we have hordes of, let's say, 85% of the population, for argument's sake, the way American politics works, it really looks like doesn't fucking matter. I mean, look at, gun reform is a great example where you have over 90% of the American public wants a universal background check. Well, guess what? The NRA bought the entire Republican Party, and that's enough for them to block something that 90-something percent of Americans want. And I feel like this issue is kind of the same, and that makes me feel depressed about it.
Yeah, I think you have a good point that, like, money is... Okay, so... This is something that like got Ilhan Omar in so much trouble, which is hilarious.
Yeah, she was right.
Because like anyone you talk to in politics privately about this will be like, yeah, it's money. Like we're looking for donors. Like if there are some voters who care about this, but it's very marginal. Like we're talking about some districts in New York or New Jersey, or maybe some very like evangelical district in South Georgia or something cares a lot about this. Most normie like Americans are not voting based on what happens in the Middle East. They don't care that much about it or pay that much attention to it. But donors spend a lot of time thinking about it, spend a lot of time caring about it. The reason why, though, that the public opinion shifts matter is because donors are just one aspect of political support, right? And at a time when like nobody really cares that much about it, but you can make a lot of money by signing on to whatever Israel bill is in the House or in Congress, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to just go with the donors. But if a lot of your voters are angry at you about this, if there's a lot of public discontent, if you're going against public opinion, then I don't think donors actually have unlimited power, right? If tomorrow there was a guy who was like, I'm going to give you $1 billion, Mr. Congressman, if you, like, I don't know, outlaw tacos, right? That's not going to work because people love tacos. Tacos rule, right? So, like,
but, so when are we going to see that calculation shift, Zed? That's my question. When are we going to see that calculation shift? Because it looks to me like we're already at the tipping point in terms of public opinion, but it doesn't move the politicians. If anything, the politicians keep getting worse.
Well, it's frustrating for a very obvious reason, which is that people are dying every day in huge numbers right now, right? There's a horrible war going on. We have a country that's supposed to be a close ally that's starving people. We should be able to tell our allies not to starve people, particularly when we're giving them all the weapons and all the money to do this. It should be a very obvious thing to do. But for some reason, President Biden is very reticent to do more than school Netanyahu. So it's frustrating for all these good reasons. But let me tell you guys, if you worked in politics, all the people who are working in politics right now, they have all internalized the mindset from probably, I don't know, probably since the, I would say, 1970s or 80s, that the safest, best thing to do in politics is just to sign up to whatever Israel's doing. You know, if you don't do that, donors will be angry at you. People will be calling you. People will call you anti-Semitic. There'll be media people attacking you. That's the mindset they've internalized for decades, right? So undoing that mindset, undoing that social power that's been created, it's a much longer process than a few months, unfortunately. And what sucks about that is the situation is so severe and bad right now. It would be best if it changed right now, right? But there are signs of changes, right? You know, Chuck Schumer has not withdrawn his support from the war, but he did say that Netanyahu should go. He did say Israel is killing too many civilians. That guy would never have said anything like that 5 years ago even, right? He would never, I've never heard him say anything critical of the Israeli government up until a few months ago, right? This guy was hardcore. I remember he would go to like meetings of Orthodox Jews and say that it makes sense to starve Gaza or strangle Gaza economically until they change their government. You know, they don't read the Torah. They don't know what it's all about. Like he would say extremely like ethno-nationalist, narcissistic type things and like borderline racist. And now he's saying, hey, look, Netanyahu should go. And they are killing too many people. Like, it's not right, right? That's a shift for someone even as adamant as Chuck Schumer, right? It's the same thing, I think, with a lot of the members of Congress who never said a critical word about anything Israel did, who are now saying that, you know, far too much killing has happened. They need to reach some kind of ceasefire. Netanyahu is bad for the government of Israel. There needs to be two states. But, you know, I think there have been some real intangible shifts, even where I used to work, Center for American Progress, right? Nir Tanden used to run Center for American Progress. When I worked there, I remember I wrote a report about Gaza's humanitarian crisis, because even before this war, Gaza was in bad shape, right? Because they had a blockade on it that kind of crippled the economy, kept them, most of them poor, most of them food insecure. They weren't starving to death, but they were probably like one or two clicks away from that, right? It just kind of sucked living there. I wrote a report about it. It was so much fear within the think tank, people going back and forth about, you know, the tone of it, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Now, the head of Center for American Progress is saying we should condition arms sales to Israel. We need to be thinking about putting conditions on the weapons we give them. If anyone at Center for American Progress has said that publicly, they'd probably either apologize the next day, or if they didn't, they'd be fired when I worked there, right? So there are a bunch of shifts in politics that are happening slowly. And it's frustrating that they're happening slowly, because the situation is so severe, right? But they are happening. And I'll tell you, one of the best data points for this is that when a lot of these Israel groups, I don't even like calling them pro-Israel because they're making Israel behave suicidally. So I don't even like calling them pro-Israel. But a lot of these Israel advocacy groups, when they're running these ads and these commercials within the Democratic primaries, they're not even mentioning the word Israel, right? In Summer Lee's race, where Jeff Yass was funding a super PAC, Jeff Yass is a big GOP donor, but he funds a bunch of Israel stuff. He funds like some Israeli think tanks even in Israel. When he was running his super PAC, I think put like 800,000 or something into the race. They didn't even mention the word Israel. None of the ads were about Israel. They were about other like tertiary, like Democratic partisan or domestic issues and things like that, right? When APAC's PAC ran an ads in the race to replace Katie Porter in California, not a single one of the ads mentioned the word Israel, right? And the reason why, I think, is because they've lost public opinion so severely, they can't even mention their own issue, right? They have to try to utilize other issues to attack people they don't like. And I think that's not where they want to be politically, right? They don't want to be in a spot where their issue has become toxic among one political party, which increasingly has become toxic, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, is it going to change over time? I think it is changing over time. I can't predict the future. But I don't think that, you know, I remember I met with a guy in the Jewish community in Atlanta like a few months ago. He's kind of a big wig and he spends a lot of time doing Israel advocacy. He's really worried about young people, particularly young Jewish people, right? And, you know, his theory was that maybe as they get older, they'll get more conservative. And the thing is, sometimes people do get a little more conservative when they get older, when they have kids, and maybe they think more about crime or taxes. I don't really see them changing their view about some foreign policy issue, particularly when the country in question is not doing anything to compromise or accommodate them, right? If Israel brought in someone like Yitzhak Rabin and maybe was trying to negotiate with the Palestinians more and say, okay, we'll be open to you having your own country, that might help sway public opinion in the United States. But as long as the government is so extreme over there, and by the way, the younger generations of Israelis are even more right-wing than the people who are in power right now. It's actually the opposite of the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
As long as the situation over there keeps getting worse, I don't see people here in America changing their views to be more in favor of that government, right? And eventually, it'll be the case that even some rich people have this point of view, I think, right? Some of these young kids might grow up and be some startup gazillionaire in Silicon Valley, and they'll say, hey, now that I have a gazillion dollars, I can put $100 million into a super PAC designed to promote Palestinian rights and statehood or nationality, right? It could happen, right? It's not impossible. There are gazillionaires behind some progressive causes, right? Like George Soros supports criminal justice reform because it's something that he happened to feel passionate about and wanted to put work into. So, you know, I guess that's a very long-winded answer to your concern, Kyle, but there are some reasons for optimism on this, particularly in the long run, long term. It's just very frustrating that it's long term.
Yeah, well, that's it. As you wonder, like, by the time those changes happen, is it going to be too late? I mean, that's the reality given what we're watching. I mean, now we have Joe Biden floating, we're going to take in Palestinian refugees, which on the one hand, okay, you know, I'm happy to have Palestinians here. On the other hand, it's like, we're going to help Israel do their ethnic cleansing.
Right.
That's our plan.
Yeah, and also some of it is just like, this is my view of it. I see it as like PR virtue signaling from the likes of Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden when they go out there and they go, tut, tut, you're killing way too many civilians. I'm against that, sir. Anyway, here's $24 billion more in weapons. It's like, it's hard for me to look at that and feel positive when at the same time we're getting TikTok is being banned. I think the main reason for that is because there's so much pro-Palestine
Definitely.
Content on there. They just codified an insane definition of anti-Semitism, which includes criticisms of Israel as anti-Semitic. So I see the power, the money, and the politics of this all going in one direction. At the same time, the public sentiment is going in the correct direction, but I just don't see that impacting the power centers, and it's driving me crazy.
One thing, Zed, that I took note of that I wanted to get your reaction to is, you know, there's a lot of discourse now about like the wisdom of the protest tactics, right? In particular, the blocking of roadways, the occupation of Hamilton Hall, as you indicated, that's been done multiple times in Columbia's not so distant history. But that's come up as, oh, they, you know, property violence and they broke windows and they're trespassing, et cetera. In fact, I was just reading as we're speaking, the president is speaking and giving his comments and making mention of those sorts of things. And some of the tactical analysis is, you know, yes, we now all look at the anti-Vietnam War protests and we're like, they were right. But also the chaos of that era helped to spark this conservative backlash and leads to Richard Nixon and ultimately to Ronald Reagan, et cetera, et cetera. So prior to this moment, I had this sense of like, if Joe Biden loses because young people hate him because they think he's doing a genocide, then it will be the first time that people really look at this and are like, oh, you had something politically to lose by being too pro-Israel. Now I think it's going to be, oh, there was this conservative like law and order backlash to the quote unquote chaos on college campuses akin to the, you know, law and order backlash in the 70s that brought in Richard Nixon.
Yeah, I think it depends a little bit what actually happens in the vote. If it's a matter of Joe Biden loses Michigan and Georgia because a lot of Arab Muslim young people and African Americans don't vote, or vote against him, or, you know, so on and so forth, that'll be one narrative, right? If it's a matter of a lot of like swing voters are, you can see evidence that they're swinging to the right because they think there's too much chaos in the country, then that'll be another narrative. But I don't think, just because it's like, it's not like there's a crime wave. It's not like there's cities being burned down. It's not like there are riots, right? It's like there's protests at colleges most people don't have any relationship to, except for like New York media, which is obsessed with them because they love the Ivy League and they love Columbia. And it's over an issue that's kind of esoteric to a lot, still esoteric to a lot of Americans, right, the Middle East. So, like, I don't see the law and order thing happening. The first thing, I'm very curious about whether that'll happen or not, because usually foreign policy does not rise to a voting issue to that extent. That being said, there is some evidence, I think, that a substantial number of people may actually vote that way in this election. And I do wonder if that happens, what the long-term political ramifications of it will be. For instance, George H.W. Bush, in his election, alienated, I think, a lot of the Israel types, because he put pressure on Israel to come to peace talks and to talk to Arafat and talk to the PLO. And he did that publicly, right? Like, James Baker had a very colorful remark he made about that, where I think he said, F the Jews, they don't vote for us anyway, right? Like, that was a whole thing. And I think probably after that all happening, the Republicans kind of felt like, okay, we need to be more supportive of Israel. We need to inculcate this base, blah, blah, blah. And they kind of shifted after that happened, right? Is it possible that, like, the reverse happens this time, that, like, there's no evidence that Jewish voters left Biden? They're still going to vote about 70% for Biden. But there's evidence that other subsets of the Democratic base, either their vote was depressed, or they voted for third party, or they even voted for Trump, because there are some reasons to vote for Trump for some of these constituents. I mean, they're a little bit more fiscally conservative, socially conservative. There's some reason to think Trump would actually end the war. I actually think there's a decent chance he would end the war, because he wants the Abraham Accords. And that won't happen unless the war is ended. Saudi needs that to ink the deal. And he loves deals, and that's his legacy. So if that happens, it may very well be the case. A lot of Democrats look back and say, look, it was a mistake for us to hinge our election on Benjamin Netanyahu. And going forward, in this situation, we need to pay more attention to our own base. They're just as powerful as these Jewish donors we're scared of. They're just as powerful. And the Jewish vote is by and large liberal. They didn't really leave us. And so, you know, maybe we should pay more attention to this group in the future. It could be a reverse of kind of what happened to George H.W. Bush, or what happened in some other elections where I think people lost for being too critical of Israel. There have been a number of elections like that. This could be an election that goes in the other direction, provided this issue is still live and active by then. I mean, if I was Joe Biden, I would try to end the war as soon as possible. There are no political upsides to his current policy position. And I think some people speculate that Biden just believes in what he's doing. It's possible that he really does just believe in it. I mean, this is a guy who grew up at the time where he viewed Israel as an underdog. You know, he always talks about his conversations with Golda Meir. He's very, 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 at this point, ancient prime minister of Israel. Has very little to do with modern Israel. It's possible that he's just a true believer in this. He feels like he needs to see it through. And as far as what he's willing to do politically, it's like what you were saying, Kyle. They will occasionally leak that, you know, he scolded Netanyahu, or they'll do meetings with Muslim Americans and Arab Americans to talk through their concerns about this, which, by the way, wasn't something Barack Obama or previous presidents did. And they are making a new effort, but it's largely communications-based or public relations-based, right? It's not based on changing their policy substantially. And, you know, yeah, it's very difficult to say, because we don't know whether the war will still be going on through November. I think if it ends, it won't be less of a factor. And then, too, we just don't know what's going to happen in the election.
You know, Zed, one thing I was going to ask on a different topic, Kyle, I don't know if you have anything else on this.
Nope.
You know, we were talking about your political evolution earlier, and one thing I wanted to ask you about is some of how you think now about some of the discourse on wokeness and anti-wokeness and DEI and these sorts of things, because, you know, I have a critique of wokeness, especially the things that get into, like, okay, now we're going to do reverse racism and we're going to make the country more sectarian. You know, I have a real revulsion to that. I also have a revulsion to the use of identity as, like, a shield to protect the status quo, like the Hillary Clinton famous, you know, like, breaking up the big banks won't solve racism, that sort of weaponization. It's very neoliberal in origin of identitarian politics. But I also am now, like, very loath to talk about it, because I see the way that on the right, this discourse, first of all, has now been flipped. So when you do have Silicon Valley Bank failing, for example, they're like, it's because of wokeness. It's because they had a gay on the board, and with Boeing, right? Boeing is failing because of wokeness.
That's exactly the frustration, because the critique of wokeness, DEI, and all this that I always identified with was kind of like the Adolf Reed Jr. version of the critique, right? Which is that a lot of this stuff is superficial, CYA, you know, corporations are going to have people lecture you about your privilege or whatever in your HR meeting once a year. It's it's like a lot of it's pointless and some of it's counterproductive, right? Like it makes people more angry and upset that they're getting lectured about these things when that's not really the way to convince people to be tolerant or accepting. You want to,
I mean, studies show it actually makes people more racist. Some of the wokeness training.
Go to this class. Yeah. You're a racist. All right, now go back.
I never really, but I think the problem is though that I don't really identify with the right-wing critiques of a lot of these things because the right-wing critiques of a lot of these things have, you know, they come in a few different flavors. One is that there isn't any racism in America anymore, which is just stupid. Like, if you believe that, it's just like a stupid thing to believe. Like,
correct, yes.
And I think, and the other one is like what you said, is that, okay, so first corporations were using DEI as like a distraction. Like, you know, like Delta company should not like be giving these kind of diversity seminars to their employees. They should let they should be supportive of their pilots and flight attendants unionizing and doing whatever they can to put pressure on airports like Hartsfield-Jackson, where I live, the world's busiest airport, where so many people who work there are poor. You know, if it's the busiest airport in the world, then they should be bringing in enough revenue to pay everyone a great wage, right? They should be doing things like that to support poor and low-income people who are disproportionately Black and Latino, particularly in Atlanta. And by the way, that's why Atlanta has a Black middle class to begin with, because when Hartsfield-Jackson was created, the mayor actually made sure to steer contracts to underrepresented communities, which I think was fully justified coming right out of Jim Crow. So that's why Atlanta has a Black middle class in the first place. So that airport should continue to be an anchor, I think, for the poor and low wage. So Delta could do that instead. But now what's happening is, okay, it's not Delta using DEI to distract from that stuff. Or, I mean, they're still doing that. But now it's also conservatives using the fact that Delta uses DEI to blame everything on DEI and also distract from all that stuff, right?
Right.
Like, Their critique of Boeing was that Boeing set some like racial recruitment target or something. I don't know, something like that. But it has nothing to do with the current Boeing scandal. It has nothing to do with why their planes are unsafe. You know, their CEO is a white dude, right? He's like a private equity guy, right? Like he's like a Mitt Romney type, right? Like he's not a Ashada Sakur or Malcolm X, right? Like that's not the thing.
And it also became. So this was also very noteworthy after the Baltimore Bridge collapse and the, you know, relatively young Black mayor is giving a press conference.
DEI mayor.
People are tweeting out that this is the DEI mayor. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is a man who got elected by like an overwhelming majority of his constituents. There was no affirmative action DEI, whatever.
Yeah, it's a Black city. The DEI then, mayor would be if it was a white mayor.
It's just, you know, in that moment, it's like, oh, you're just using this to say like Black people aren't qualified to do anything. Any position they're in, it must be because of some like affirmative action program that got them there. And so, like I said, like it's not that I wasn't aware that this was being used in this way by the right. I was aware of it. And I always try to like make a distinction in my critique of wokeness or DEI or whatever. But at this point, I just feel like to give that critique any oxygen is just, it's so beside the point of what the real problems are. And it's been so twisted and weaponized in this disgusting and racist way that I just don't want to touch it at all.
What they did is they proved their left-wing critics right. They proved their hardest left critics correct. Because the hardest left critics for the whole time were saying, you don't actually mean the thing you're saying. You're just against having Black people in like any positions.
Yes.
And at the time, you're like, come on, that sounds ridiculous. And then they go on to kind of prove that.
Now they're like, no, that's actually what we
meant. Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's true that like a huge portion of the like cultural right, like the people who are pundits or who work in right-wing media, a number of the politicians do feel that way. That doesn't mean that if like Delta Corporation for some reason came to me and asked me if they should be doing any of this, I would tell them that they should. I would tell Delta Airlines you should end all of it because it's counterproductive, right? Like I will still have a critique of it, but you guys are absolutely correct that when somebody is now when people are just like attacking any Black person for existing in their position and assuming they didn't get their job fairly or competently or that they lack merit, you don't want to associate with that. And I think that's part of politics too, which is like, you need to be able to make your critique and not endure someone else's critique who maybe has the same target as you, but is coming at it from a completely different direction. And, you know, I think even with respect to some of the, you know, the other issues we were talking about earlier, that does happen sometimes, right? Like, I think that there are, when I watch some of the protests on campuses, and again, they're 18 years old, like, so like, what do I expect? But I feel like they do like lump a bunch of other issues into the war, right? And like I wrote a piece for Persuasion and for Lee Fong's blog, Substack, where I like Students for Justice for Palestine, if you go on their website, like they don't even call the United States the United States, they call it Turtle Island. And like that's apparently like a name some natives use to call the United States. I'm like, that's fine if you believe that, but like you need to like focus on the thing, right? And I wouldn't want people to think, because I think the war is wrong, the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians is wrong, that also means that I think like the United States is wrong, and like we should all leave and give it to some Native Americans or whatever like that line of thinking is, right? So it's the same with this. I think that there is a proper critique of DEI that most Americans can resonate with, that it's a lot of like bureaucracies created largely for public relations reasons by corporate America for the most part and some government, but it's not actually solving the problem. It's not actually promoting more tolerance. And by the way, the actual civil rights movement didn't care that much about attitudes or about tolerance, right? Like they talked about it a little bit, but I remember watching an old black and white clip of like a bunch of civil rights leaders being interviewed. I think maybe King was in the panel. I don't know. A bunch of top level people were in the panel. And they were like, look, we don't care that much that there's racism out there. There's always gonna be racism. What we care about is that the force of law is supporting the racism, right? Because that's what gives it teeth. That's what makes it powerful in the hands of people. And I think that's what we need to think about when we come to both this issue and the issue we were discussing earlier. I think there's always going to be some people who have prejudicial ideas about African Americans, Latinos, Arabs, Muslims, white people, Jews. There's people who are going to have prejudicial ideas. The question is, are the structures in our society empowering those prejudicial ideas, giving them teeth and power to where they actually deny people opportunities, to where they actually discriminate, to where they take people's lives, right? Those are the major problems. It's not me reaching into everyone's mind and perfectly sanitizing them, right? That's impossible. And it's often counterproductive, right? But I think when it comes to these issues of, you know, are we going to, look, I'll give you a good example. Like when I lived in Washington, D.C., I think psychologically, I often associated being black with being poor, because when I was in that area, pretty much every black person you would meet was either a service employee or they lived in East DC, they were low income, right? That happened to me, even though I grew up in Atlanta, which is like the biggest black middle class in the United States. And I no longer think that way when I see a black person in Atlanta, because there's so many successful black people in Atlanta. But what's the difference between the two places? The difference between the two places is that Atlanta was purposely built to spread wealth around to people who were discriminated against during Jim Crow era. And I think it was very successful. And there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, particularly the Republican state lawmakers, I think, are not that interested in having a more progressive tax code or healthcare policy, so on and so forth. But it did change how I felt and thought about things, just simply because the structure of the society is different, right? And that you have just a lot more wealth spread out among working and middle-class black people where they can have a good life. Whereas in a place like DC or Baltimore, there's just so much black poverty everywhere that I think that, you know, it changes also just the way that you think. So I'm less interested in like brainwashing everyone into having a certain set of ideas. I'm much more interested in changing the conditions of society, because that will also change how people think over time. But it's much, much more important to change those conditions of the society to make sure that everyone has, you know, what they need and that they can live a dignified life. And to me, the DEI stuff, none of it even remotely relates to any of those ideas. It doesn't remotely change the structure of society. And in fact, what it seems to, the main thing it seems to have done is, one, annoyed a lot of people who have to sit through these things. And two, the right is now using it as just like a wedge issue to distract from everything else we were just discussing, right?
Yeah.
From actually
yeah.
changing the society.
The thing is, there's like, there are cynical critiques that like sort of smuggle in a whole different agenda, and they're honest critiques, right? And it's hard to sort of differentiate between the two and see it all in real time. A good example of this is Bill Maher just did this new rule segment where he like was nuanced trolling and like strategy mongering the way that all these pro-Palestine protests are happening. But the thing that he's hiding is that he's actually against them in substance. Like, he doesn't agree with the protesters.
Right.
So it's not good faith advice. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I feel like in this conversation, it's very similar. You can have a legitimate, like, I know you're a person, just like I am too. You know, I'm a person who believes in the ideal, the MLK ideal of like a colorblind society, and that's the way to go about it. But there's also people who sort of nefariously use that to mask a true agenda, which is actually not in favor of that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, which is like, no, we can't talk about race at all.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
It's like, no, that's not. The other thing that drives me crazy is that this is a little bit of an aside and less of an important point, but it really irritates the hell out of me. The way that, you know, a corporation putting in some DEI initiative, or like Jamie Dimon kneeling in front of a bank vault for Black Lives Matter, how this was used to claim that corporate America is actually left wing, or university administrators are actually left wing. Oh, really? They're actually left wing Marxists? I mean, it's just like it confuses much more than it illuminates the actual politics and the actual sources of power out there.
This was my discussion with Noam Dorman, because he kept saying, you know, university is so left wing. And I'm like, you know, like Henry Kissinger was an academic. That's where he came from, was academia. And Nixon picked him as an academic, kind of as an outside man. And he came and he returned to academia largely. He was celebrated across academia throughout his entire life. If you go to Harvard or Princeton or Yale or Stanford, where Condoleezza Rice teaches, or she did teach, I think she still teaches there, you will find the echelon of the elite who staff our foreign policy apparatus, who staff corporate America, who staff Wall Street, who even staff like the fossil fuel industry. These people, you know, I think the reality of it is that instead of thinking about these institutions as left wing or right wing, they're about power, right?
Yeah.
And the people who hold power are not necessarily, you know, necessarily all in one area. I think it's probably true that like America's elite are a little bit more socially liberal. They're probably more pro-choice. They're probably more pro-immigration, but they're not pro everything on the left, right? Like they like their money is a big part of it. I think that I don't think these universities have to worry about Arab American donors calling them and saying, look, if you suppress these protests too much, I'm going to take away my, you know, $500,000 chair at this, you know, department or something, right? They don't have to worry about that because they don't have the power, right? It's not a left-wing versus right-wing thing. It's just who has the power. And many of these university departments, I think people have the power who don't align with progressives right now. It just happens to be the case. And it's not always that way. It's not always in that direction, but that's how it is. And I don't, you know, nobody in Congress is going to write up a bill describing exactly what you can say about an Arab or a Palestinian that's racist and how we'll cut off funding to your university if someone says that, right? No one's doing that because they don't have the power. And that's part of why this like massive crackdown may not actually even help. There are some people who sincerely, I think there's an anti-Semitism crisis and do sincerely want to help Jewish Americans. I think some people who work at some of the Jewish organizations like ADL and AJC, I think they probably really believe that. But let me ask them this, is like, is it really helping you? It's like DEI. Is it really going to help people to try to like, to for people to be sitting there and watching like openly Jewish donors say, we're no longer going to give money to this university if you don't do what we say? That's promoting stereotypical thinking, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's every like fever swamp, like a stormfront 4chan type person is like, huh, that's exactly what I was telling you guys my whole life. Look, the Jews run America, right? That's not helpful for that cause, right? It's not at all helpful to do that. And it's the same thing with DEI. And you know, Republicans now have their own version of DEI on behalf of Israel, which they're framing as an anti-Semitism issue. But if you sincerely care about these issues, there's other things that we should be doing, right? There's other forms of dialogue that need to be happening between Arabs and Jewish Americans and Arab Americans. There's other forms of dialogue that need to be happening between African Americans and white Americans. And most importantly, I think what I was saying earlier is you just have to have a more fair distribution of power and wealth in America, right? You need to make sure that someone doesn't look around and when they see a Latino or a Black person, they instantly think that's a poor person who's below me, right? Because they are poorer than you. They have been denied opportunities. They don't have the same, station in life. But if it was more fair, if we could look at someone and if what we thought the image of a doctor was, and it could be any color person, because the society was repaired, you know, the breaches in society have been repaired sufficiently for that to be, I think we'd all be way better off, right? But that doesn't take, you know, dressing people down and hitting them with a stick if they say the wrong thing, right? That takes working really hard to bring a lot of people up who historically have not been up. And I think you know, my example of Atlanta was part of that, and that I think there's a lot more respect down here for African Americans than there are in other parts of the country. Ironically, when people think, they think about Jim Crow and they think about the South. But I think there is a lot more respect just because we built a big old black middle class and people with power. And I think the same thing applies to a lot of these other issues. There needs to be a more even playing field when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, where Arab Americans don't feel like they just completely ignored, or that they can, their relatives can be killed by the thousands overseas and they're just scolded for even protesting that, right? That is going to create resentment against Jewish Americans. The Israel-Palestine conflict is the number one source of Arab-Jewish resentment and hatred in the world, right?
That's right.
I don't want to be lectured by Benjamin Netanyahu about anti-Semitism because he's creating it. Everything he does creates it. It'd be like being lectured by Osama bin Laden about Islamophobia. It's like, dude, you're the problem. Yeah. You know, yeah. You're creating this. You're creating such a bad image to your people through your behavior and by the claim that you represent all your people. That's the most toxic part, because no one person can represent an entire group of millions and millions of people, right? But he keeps claiming to speak in their name, you know, and that is just such a toxic thing. And I wish that the Jewish American organizations would embrace and endorse my point of view on that. But every time I raise it to them, I think to them, it's just inseparable. You have to support everything Israel does if you're Jewish, right?
Greenblatt is horrible from the ADL. Oh. I mean, he's an absolute sick joke. But we're running out of time, Zed, but I got two more questions that I wanted to ask you. But let's try to keep it brief because we're running out of time here. But so you were a guy who was a Bernie guy, just like me and Crystal. And then I saw, you know, I follow your Twitter account and stuff and your writing. And it seemed to me like for a little bit there, you were flirting with DeSantis, but then now you've also turned on him too. So how does one go from like Bernie to being interested in DeSantis to then turning on DeSantis?
Well, look, I don't think I was ever in a place where I was going to like endorse and work for candidates that were, I think, promoting those kind of ideas. So much as I think the way that DeSantis approached COVID was basically the right way. I think that a lot of what happened in schools, like I was living in Northern Virginia at the time when COVID was happening. A lot of what the Democrats did around schools during COVID, I think, was disastrous. It was very, very harmful for children. It was not analogous to what was being done in most of Western and Northern Europe, which I think took a different approach. And I do think DeSantis standing on principle on some of those issues was important and was helpful to the children in Florida. And I think some other governors like Kemp and you know, they did similar. And I think that's praiseworthy no matter who it comes from. It could come from a Democrat, it could come from a Republican, whatever. But I think once DeSantis developed a national platform, there was very little difference between him and the National Republican Party, right? And that's, I think, part of the problem. If for a little while it seemed like Trump had created an opening just because he's an eccentric personality and he's not a purely orthodox Republican, he created an opening for some like rethinking on the right, right? And I think some people have kind of walked through the opening a little bit, like, you know, Senator J.D. Vance, Senator Josh Hawley. I think they sort of understand that there's more to life than just like sucking up to corporations, right? You can support family policy, you can support some things on unions. Josh Hawley just came out against right to work, which is, I think, the correct position for him to take. But they're still a marginal part of the Republican Party. And as much as I can encourage the Republican Party to spend more time thinking about working people, thinking about families, thinking about, you know, not being 100% just like five memes from the 1980s running their political party, as much as I can encourage that, I would. But I don't think DeSantis is really doing that at this point. I think DeSantis has become a hard right Republican, right? I don't think that I think when he first ran in 2018, he actually had some moderate characteristics that helped him. But I don't think he seems at all interested in being on the reform wing of the party. As far as who is, it would be the individuals I mentioned, like J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley, although they're not very reform when it came to the topics we're discussing today. I don't think they're more in line with their Christian evangelical base, I think, on those topics. And from what I understand, Hawley is very authentically religious, so maybe he even believes it. Maybe it's not 100% politics with him to do that. I think of myself less in terms of party and more in terms of, you know, being an American who's concerned about his country. And I want to encourage the right attitudes and dispositions among both the major parties or anyone else who can get into power. There are occasionally independents who win, like Bernie Sanders. I want to encourage those attitudes among people. I want to encourage reforms. I don't think that if you work for AIPAC or Wall Street, you care much about party. You want them to support your agenda, right? So I feel the same way. Unfortunately, I think a lot the reform wing of the Republican Party is very stymied at this point. But on the other hand, you know, Josh Hawley and J.D. Vance are the two youngest Republican senators. In 20 years' time, will there be a lot more of them? Will they have a lot more power and influence? I would hope so, because I think they're much better than the average Republican, and I think that would help the Democrats pass legislation that's needed if it wasn't so part. If all these issues like healthcare, living wages, so on and so forth, weren't so partisan. So.
Yeah, and we could wrap it up on that note. I understand where that perspective comes from, but I also would just say that when it comes to somebody like Josh Hawley, he voted against a $15 minimum wage, and I find like the populist Republicans always on like 92% of the issues just divert to being regular Republicans when push comes to shove. So
he did introduce his own like minimum wage increase bill, which is weird because like it also increased minimum wage by a lot. It just like I think it was actually even 15 maybe, but it was like per the size of your business. But anyway, I think with Hawley also there's a partisanship issue, right? Where like he doesn't want to give the Democrats a win sometimes, and like that's part of maybe what was happening there too.
Yeah, so it's $15 minimum wage for billion-dollar corporations. But that leaves a lot of people not getting a $15 minimum wage.
No, he does try to carve out his third way a lot, which somewhat is his beliefs and somewhat is just him being partisan.
Yeah, but he was also against the PRO Act, as Crystal knows. She loves the PRO Act. I mean, the pro-union legislation. It's like you're always going to – it's always like, you know, one step forward, two steps back with those people. Right. So I'm a little more skeptical of how they conduct themselves.
There's a whole other conversation about – I think it was the Teamsters actually endorsed him in his Senate race, which is interesting because he used to have more – labor support for Republicans, and on the one hand you're like, all right, but this guy is with you on a lot fewer issues than a Democrat would be. On the other hand, if you have some monetary incentive for Republicans to be better on the issues, that would be a better thing. So in any case, we can leave that one for another day.
And we can get into your interesting back and forth with Taibbi in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Zed, tell people where they can follow you and find your work.
Yeah, so, you know, mostly I'm working as a consultant and freelancing. So I'm consulting for some organizations doing comms work, but also I'm freelance writing and doing journalism still. But mostly I just post my things on social media. So if you follow me on Twitter or find me on Facebook, you usually see myself that way.
Well, it's great to catch up with you. Thanks for taking the time with us today. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Zed. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, so that's Zed Jelani. We didn't even get to the juiciest thing, which is the back and forth he did with Matt Taibbi. Basically, the gist of it is Matt Taibbi is basically like, yeah, I don't criticize Republicans anymore. And Zed's like, well, that's pretty fucking dumb.
Yeah,
and
he was
like,
on with Brianna.
Bro, you're a hack. That was Taibbi's response is like, whatever, bro.
But it was, if your whole thing has been free speech and censorship, like, I just don't know how you can't be, you know, up at arms right now, and there's this massive crackdown unfolding before our eyes.
Yeah, but if you've cultivated an audience of right-wingers and Republicans, and they're sucking the teat of Israel, maybe you don't want to step into that minefield.
It's hard to avoid that conclusion.
Yeah.
Hard to avoid that conclusion.
It's been interesting seeing his evolution, because there was a time when everything I saw from him was, like, really left-wing, the Think Progress articles and stuff like that. And then there was a time where every time I would see him tweet something, it would be some, like, populist right type shit.
Yeah.
And then I think this Israel thing sort of was the straw that broke the camel's back, where he's back to going hard in the paint against the Republicans and the
like
conservatives.
Israel has brought a lot of lefties home, because it's just so, if you have any sort of like leftist bone of morality in your body, you have to look at this slaughter of children and utter annihilation and feel like that's wrong and see very clearly which side, you know, you should be on and how history is going to view this time.
Yep. That's right. All right, guys, we love y'all very much. Thank you as always for listening. You know the drill. Everybody could sign up below on Substack. If you pay $5 a month, you get the video of every interview or debate and you get it a day early, or you could sign up for free and get it delivered right to your email inbox when it hits as an audio podcast a day later. That's all we got, y'all. Everybody have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon. Peace.